The title itself, so The Subjugation of Canadian Wildlife, Failures of Principle and Policy, that term itself is a very strong word. And I think when people read this book, it's the theme that is throughout the entire book.
Yeah,
basically.
I try to be consistent, yes.
Yeah, it's it definitely tells people what this book is about. And why do you think it was so important to write this book now, at this time?
That's a good question, because it has the, of course, I'm conscious of what's happening to wildlife. I live out here in the country, out of Calgary,
yeah.
And we have lots of wildlife.
Yes.
Mainly with my wife. You see, my training is in, my PhD is in history, but I'm not a wildlife person. But my late wife, was a very, very staunch advocate, animal rights, big time. And she got me interested in wildlife, and her love and compassion touched me so much. And she said to me one day, she said, "Max, you've got to write a book on this." And I said, it's not for me. I said, she said, "Max, you're the only one who can do it." And I said, "Okay, I promise I'll do it." And then I took a year off to write it. I took a year off in 2013, and I was going to research and write it, and then she got cancer. And so she was being treated all the time I was writing it. And so I wrote it for wildlife. I wrote it for her, and I wrote it for me, but mainly for her. That's why I wrote it, because someone had to say it, and I had to say it my own way, because it's not that people out there are consciously subjugating wildlife because they like to do it. It's because they are driven by a set of beliefs, and the belief system is what's wrong. And as long as you operate with those belief systems that says you stand outside nature and animals have no moral standing, once you say that, it's open season. Because animals do have moral standing, and the right to a quick death and absence of cruelty is not enough. And once you believe that animals have no moral standing beyond that, it's deterministic after that. It's game over, in my opinion. But I do acknowledge a change in attitude. I do acknowledge that. But whether it's a change enough to eat into the belief system, I don't know. But there is a change, and I did acknowledge it. I think if you use your common sense and if you approach it, I think our tendency to rationalise is our, you know, we most of us, all of us pretty well, our thought process are basically rooted in rationalisations, and very rarely do we stand outside those rationalisations and try to be rational. And when you rationalise, you get the answer you want.
Yes.
So when you don't, and anyway.
So I'm curious, what has the feedback been like? And I'm talking about for me, maybe your fellow colleagues, the people in wildlife conservation, policymakers. Like, have you had a lot of feedback?
I've had feedback from people like the fur bearers, Animal Alliance, ZooCheck, Eco Justice, Alberta Institute of Wildlife Conservation. The feedback from academics has been very, very strong. Feedback from academics, and big academics like Mark Beckhoff and Paul Perkay.
Yes.
They're strong support.
Mm-hmm.
And the review I've read was by a guy at work for the Environment Canada, and he said in the review he's prepared to hate this book. But he said, by the time I finished it, he was with me. My only criticism was he thought I hit too hard. Well, I didn't hit hard enough. But I hit much harder in the first draft, and then I said to myself, no, back off. And feedback, I think, has been very good, but I think that a lot of people still think I'm criticising wildlife policy, maybe I didn't make myself clear enough. I was criticizing the belief system that underpins wildlife policy more than wildlife policy. But generally positive. In fact, I expected a lot of negative, but I had no one come after me, and no nasty emails, which pleases me, particularly out here in this country where hunting is hunting is very popular.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
I mean, I know I've gotten nasty emails for things I've said. So.
I bet you have. Yeah. It goes with the territory, Victoria. It goes with the territory.
Oh, and you know, the reason I asked you this question, because like you said, you do touch on things that are normally considered taboo in conservation, like animal rights and speciesism. So I was curious to see, you know, what that, you know, feedback or pushback was going to be like, because you bring that in.
You see, anyone who wants to come at me can't. I mean, you can't come at me because I'll shoot you down. They've got no argument except for there was one negative from a guy he was a friend of mine who liked the book, asked me to read it, and he works for Alberta Fish and Wildlife. Well, he didn't like the book. He said that I should have been more hermeneutical with guys like Aquinas. But I've known Aquinas. I've known Aquinas since I was 10-year-old. I'm Catholic trained, and I know all about it, you know.
Yes.
And that I was making overstatements. But I didn't. I quoted from the record. And he didn't like it, but he couldn't attack me. And that's what pleased me, the fact that he couldn't attack me. Because I'm just going after the belief system, and you can't tackle me on that, except to resort into mysticism and superior beings in the clouds and man's divine right into myth. And if you myth and rationalization, you can take me on, but not by argument, no.
Yeah, and not by history that has been recorded, right?
I tried to cover myself, but you can't always, because you know, I mean, there's some weak points in the manuscript, generally I tried to be consistent within my argument, and I tried not to make it a polemic. I did go after Parks Canada a bit. I did go after them.
That's okay.
But yeah, they deserve it. In part, anyway.
Getting into all of these issues around conservation, how important is it for readers that they make this connection between beliefs and our views of wildlife and our current policies
Crucial.
In Canada?
Crucial. It has to be done. You have to align your beliefs. As Tom Regan said, people will not change their behavior until they beliefs. And it has to be seen as animals have to be seen as sentient beings co-inhabiting our planet and doing far less damage to it than we are. And so it might be a good idea. What Mary Midgley says, we live with animals, therefore it seems reasonable we should take them seriously, you know.
Yeah.
But where that'll start, Tori, I don't know. Whether it be books like this or whether it be people like you who are pounding it out in the trenches down there, doing it the hard way, or whether it'll be education or whether it'll be some a realization that we're losing our wildlife. I don't know what will be the pivotal. I think probably it'll be a sudden realization that we're losing our wildlife, and there we should do something about it.
You know, what I like about this book is that, you know, you make us understand our past. We understand our past, we can understand our present situation. So you bring up a lot of points, and I hear this thrown around about, you know, the conservation heroes of old. And it's just Canadian and American, you know, Americans, Teddy Roosevelt. Like, I had this conversation with someone who I really respect. And I said, you know, how can we put these people on pedestals, and we still do it? And you know, there was something you said in your book, and this I had no idea about, so I'm going to quote it. So it was a former Bronx Zoo director and wildlife authority, William Hornaday.
Yeah,
in 1914 stated, wolves should be killed as quickly as possible, and cougars should be hunted down and destroyed at any cost. Now, you know, this mentality still exists. What is the danger?
Yes, it does, Tori. Yes, it does. See, that was the anti-predator mentality. I must admit, Hornaday did have a somewhat of a change of heart towards he died, but that's what he, that's what he wrote. The war against predators were considered evil because they killed and they killed other innocent creatures that couldn't hit back. But most of the war against predators, they were killing animals that the hunters would like to hunt. And so it was only with the recognition of ecological interdependence and factors that predators were seen as part of the natural order.
Mm-hmm.
Then they were quickly elevated into a prime hunting animal, and some like the wolf I just hated, and the rest are considered,
mm-hmm.
and some like the polar bear being kept alive for Inuit interests, Inuit economic interests, and they should be a threatened species. They are not. Because the feds, if the feds put them at the lower level, special concern, all that means is a management plan and nothing else. But once you say threatened, you can't hunt them. But the cougar, you know, the one you're in, is probably the less, you know, not a threat. A great threat to livestock.
No, it's not. You're right.
Very elusive, and I like mm-hmm. The Alberta Management Plan said that cougars are valuable for being hunted and for recreational purposes like sighting. I've only seen one cougar on my place in 45 years. Cougar sighting is not a recreational pursuit.
It's not.
It's like wolverine sighting. You know, you don't see them. And they don't do any harm. I mean, the only cougar I've seen was on my deck. Heather said to me one night, "Max, come here. There's a cougar on our deck." And she went out, and she was looking at him, looking at her. It was her. And they looked at each other about 5 minutes. I came out and looked over her shoulder. And then I saw she had her child just at the bottom of the steps. And then she just turned around and walked away.
That's on our deck.
Just walked away.
That's amazing. And
took a baby with her and a kid with her, and away she went.
Yeah.
And so cougars are the most maligned of all in that paranoid fear about, and that they do know. In fact, the first cougar management plan, the one that was in Alberta, the first study was done in 1988. The main draft copy was sent to the Alberta government, and the main conclusion was that the value of cougars should be seen as magnificent creatures who should be enjoyed for their aesthetic value. But of course, our government didn't want to hear that. And of course, that was taken out of the draft.
All of this basically, you know, the North American model of conservation, which is quoted in it, you know, like you point out in this book, it's clearly pointed out. I think anyone who does any sort of research can see that there is that, like you say, a moral and ethical conflict. And in terms of, like, this is seen in exploiting, like you said, exploiting wildlife for hunting, and then that in terms funds wildlife or,
exactly.
you know, conservation. And I wonder, you know, do you really think this is helping animals or just helping more animals die at the hands of hunters and bad policy?
It's a tired old mentality. I mean, the North American wildlife, that group is just classically old. You see, I went after Leopold, and gee, I went after God Almighty when you go after Leopold, you know, because Leopold's land ethic is, it's beautiful, you cannot deny it, but his attitude towards what he called game animals was different than not, but I went after him, and that North American wildlife, that model is classic Leopold, dressed up Leopold, that's what, hunters as conservationists, bullshit, hunters kill, what did the article say, the hunters kill, hunters kill prey at, 15 times the rate the predator, the
more than predators, right?
Yep, 15 times the rate, and they kill the best. It's sad to think this sort of practice is sanctioned. And of course, provincial governments are always strapped for money, and mostly they got rural constituents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, mostly not, you know, even Ontario. I mean, you've got a strong rural, little on the other provinces. And these rural constituents are going to be all in favour of of hunting because it brings in revenue and supplies jobs, and so the cycle continues.
And yeah,
it's going to be a very hard one to stop.
It's not only hunting; it's trapping too.
Yeah, trapping as well. Trapping as well. Yeah. Yes. And what surprised me when I was writing this story was that very few protected areas, very, very few protected areas, disallow hunting and trapping. Yeah, I did. I went into that big time. But I thought it was quite significant that animals are not safe in protected areas. Nope.
And I think the average person may think that, right, in terms of like the average Canadian, which brings me to my next question, and you bring this up, is Canadian involvement. Okay, so outside of like the hunting and trapping community, you know, you say it's actually a lot of people donate, but there's actually a very low percentage of people that are involved in wildlife-related issues.
Yes. Yes, because we're one of the few first world countries. Most countries who are first world countries are not rich in wildlife. The European countries are not rich, and they're desperate to bring wolves back, to bring some of this rewilding movement. It's very prominent in Europe, and we are one of the few countries who are fairly rich in wildlife, and we don't. I don't even count Australia, my native land, because you know every animal native to Australia is a marsupial, and so that'll be it's got the terrific range. It's just the states and us, and we do not show leadership at all. In fact, we are laggards in wildlife stewardship. Even African countries now are beginning to realize we've got to do something.
Yeah, they're ahead of us.
Yeah,
some of them.
Botswana, for example. We have been a laggard, and on other counts too. We one of the few nations that does not have a definition of an animal, and our cruelty record is abysmal, and our handling of the Species at Risk Act is abysmal, because it's funded very poorly, and that's why the revenues from hunting are considered valuable to provinces, because they're cash strapped.
But you mentioned something interesting in your book, and this is something that I've noticed, that they don't, you know, most charities do not challenge the belief systems. I don't know if it's just Canadians being overly polite about things, or, it's, like you said, like they can be threatened by the Canadian government, like as in the fur bearer situation.
Exactly. Using it. And if you look some of the stuff that comes out of the provincial government, the federal government, it's straight out of Stoic philosophy. I mean, it's straight out of Stoic philosophy that technically animal charities, like you, for example, have you got a charitable number?
No, this is a blog. I don't have a charitable number, but I would think twice about it.
Yeah, exactly. Good. Exactly. And so if you do get a charitable number, wildlife, you've got to show, your mandates, your mission statement has to show how what you do benefits humanity. In other words, it's not the animal. The animal doesn't matter. It makes you a better human. Being kind to animals makes you a better human. That's Aquinas, and that's classic Aquinas. It's also also probably John Locke as well. But that being kind to animals makes you a better human. That's called the indirect duties argument, and that's the basis of animal welfare. That's the basis of animal welfare. The indirect duties argument that being a better, being kind to animals makes you a better human. Although I think a lot of animal welfare people, they don't think that anymore either. The animal's never important in its own right. All domestic animals, if you hurt my dog or my cat or your dog or your cat, you're hurting you, not me, because it's my property.
Yeah.
And I quoted some justice of the Supreme Court justice. I quote him in a book.
Yes.
Like animal
I think I remember that, and it was really disturbing.
Classic Stoic. I mean, Epictetus couldn't have said it better than that. I mean, it was. And here we are. advancing ourselves in many ways across the realm of what we've done since the ancient times, and we still think we're still mired in Stoic philosophy. And that's what's sad. Still mired in Judo-Christian and Stoic philosophy.